Now, when I looked at the brethren and tried to assess what they had done, I realised that I had to look not only at historical considerations, that is, what ways did the brethren grow, but also what issues concerned them in this growth. And again, I made my set of selections. In the dissertation and in the treatment today, I am going to refer essentially and only, in fact, to people writing within Australia. I was not concerned with what people in America or UK might have said, although I recognise at times these influenced what we were doing. But all the quotations I have taken and all of the issues that have been raised are essentially Australian brethren issues, not world brethren issues. I picked up five, I think, in the thesis, and that is, and we're not treating all of these now, the issue of how we describe ourselves or call ourselves. The second, the thorny issue of ecumenism, our relationship with the churches. I looked at our theologies of the sacraments, that is, breaking of bread and the Lord's Supper. I looked at leadership structures and where we were different there. And lastly, I looked at how we handled the issue of women. Now, for today, for now, I'm hoping just to deal with three of those five, and that will be the problem of finding a name, the problem of relationships with other believers, and leadership structures. I've left at this stage the thorny issue of women. We may or may not have a look at that in one of the extra session I've got this evening. Now, it seems to me that as you read our history, we have not fought over the fundamentals. But when I use the term fundamentals, I'm thinking of the great fundamentals of the faith, like the Trinity, the deity of Jesus, the personality of the Holy Spirit, salvation by grace alone, the importance of the Scriptures. We have not fought over those. We, along with the larger churches, have accepted those as fundamentals. But what we have done is to fight over a number of issues which, in a strange way, we've suddenly let rise to become a new set of fundamentals. And some of those were those raised by Mr. Carson last night. Now, I am sure that he would agree that there is a far greater list of biblical fundamentals that had to do with the great revelation of God to the whole of the world in those things that I first mentioned. But as you read our writings, and if you go through Word and Work, if you look at articles that have been written in Tidings and in a number of other magazines, you will find many of the issues fought over and almost set up to be a whole new set of fundamentals were issues outside of that real important list of things that tell us the great things about our relationship with God. Now, therefore we go to this strange problem of finding a name. Now, let me tell you that we are not alone in this, and almost all renewal movements, as they emerge, have a hassle with what do we call ourselves. And in most cases, before they've determined what they're going to call themselves, somebody else has called them something. Now, you cannot escape that. And therefore, I wonder if in the light of history, we are not better saying we will use this name rather than having names forced upon us. The names that have been forced upon groups of people sometimes have been quite unfortunate and frequently refuted by them. For instance, the term Anabaptist was a term of disrepute. It was a term, a slanderous term, hurled at some great renewal movements which emerged at the time of the Reformation. They got that name because they said infant baptism was practiced by the Catholic Church and the geographical churches, the national churches of the day, the Lutherans, the Anglicans, and the Calvinists, was not real baptism at all. And so they would baptize again. And so as a term of abuse, their enemies hurled this word Anabaptist at them. And it stuck. Now, I'm sure they would have preferred to have chosen another name, and frequently they did not use that for themselves. We know that the word Baptist to describe a large group of people, again, was something used by others of them to describe one of their idiosyncrasies. Couldn't have they had fun with the brethren if they picked up all of their idiosyncrasies? I'm not even going to try and mention some of them. The word Methodist, again, was not chosen by Wesley or by those early people who, like the early brethren, had no intention of starting a new movement. I mean, Wesley, all his life, was an Anglican, and he died an Anglican, although he began one of the great renewal movements within the English Church. But people labelled it Methodists, or in these days, sometimes even Wesleyans. Now, fortunately, the brethren could avoid the geographical title. You'll notice that a number of churches today are called by a geographical title, like the Church in England, or the Church of England, the Church of Scotland. We were never going to be the church of a whole nation. We also avoided, I think quite thankfully, the name of a leader. Now, the Wesleyans, or at least some group of them, took up the name of John Wesley. Or the people in Germany took up the name of their great hero, Martin Luther, and the word Lutherans remains to this day. We are not known by one of the early leaders. Now, the only tragedy of that is that it means some people in our churches don't even know the name of one of our early leaders. At least the Wesleyans have got one to think about. On the other hand, it is true that in some circles, the exclusives were known as Derbyites. But that did not last very long, and certainly it was not something that they chose for themselves. But, maybe quite fortunately, we're not known as Groveites. Or Muellerites. Or some other ites that somebody might have thought up. And indeed, when there are names given to us, for instance, Plymouth Brethren, let us remember that that was a term given to us by outsiders, not chosen by insiders. The reason, of course, was that Plymouth was the largest church. Now, we are frequently embarrassed by the word Plymouth Brethren for a number of reasons, and one of the major ones is because we know at Plymouth the system failed. Because at Plymouth was that explosion, that crisis, which determined that Brethrenism would never be a force, a huge force, in the history of the church. It was tragic. But whatever happens, in 1845, and that division there and the hassles there meant that Brethrenism would never be a world force for renewal. Other forces would come in and take up the ideas of Brethrenism and leave us behind. Now that, I believe, is a true interpretation of history. But we are not happy with this term, Plymouth Brethrenism, because of the awful connotations of Plymouth. But of course, if you had known something about Plymouth in the 1840s, before the trouble, there was a church there of 1,500 people said to have more educated, learned laymen than any other church, any other church or congregation throughout the entire history of the church over 19 centuries. Such was the brilliance of the people attracted to that one church from which so much of Brethrenism emerged. So, that term then was used by outsiders, and you'll find that it's only outsiders who term the right histories about the Plymouth Brethren. Most insiders just use the term Brethren, or perhaps prefer the word open. Now again, we've tended to jump on this word open Brethren, and the reason is that we want now to make a big distinction between ourselves and them, the them of course being the exclusives. And this has become even more important, say, since the 50s and 60s, when there has been considerable dispute and debate within the exclusives, and a whole lot of bad press. So we've used this term open. I found the word open in Missionary Tidings as early as 1923. I'm sure it was used before that, but it was one of the first occasions I found of its use in our own writings. So it's not a modern term. It goes back already 60, 70 years. And indeed, On the other hand, if you're looking for a name that was used, I was interested to read in Tidings in 1913 of the tour of the term brethren in formal documents. But more importantly, and I want to read you this, because this comes out of the first Tidings issues that were ever made, which was in 1911. And it had to do with a census. Now, it was the year of a census in Australia. And the brethren got together to discuss how they would describe themselves as they had to put together a name, a religious title on the census. Now, there is something very modern about that. And to realise that back in 1911, the brethren got together almost Australia-wide to discuss what name they would put on this census. By the way, talking about censuses, our numbers now are so small that we will no longer appear as a separate name on the census forms, so that you've got to write it down rather than tick a box. That's much how much of a non-identity really we've become now. Now, that's going to mean that there will be less people appearing as brethren on the census, because it's much easier to tick a box than it is to write something, and you'll find people will just tick other or something like that rather than defining the term brethren. So it's not going to be as easy from statistics, from formal statistics or official statistics, to find out how many of us are around. But listen to this. Early in April, the census papers will be distributed throughout the Commonwealth of Australia, and amongst other questions to be answered is one relating to the denomination to which the questioner is attached. This matter has already exercised the hearts of some, particularly in Queensland, and at a united oversight meeting held in Brisbane recently of brethren from Ipswich, Bundamba, Brisbane and suburbs, it was decided to offer the following suggestions so that we might all speak the same thing. Question. What denomination? Answer. Christian. In brackets. Generally known as brethren. Close the brackets. The same answer could be filled in for children who are converted and attend the meetings, even though they are not in fellowship. In the case of other children who attend the meetings, adherents of assembly, generally known as brethren, would be adequate. Now, that really is an interesting piece of historical data, to realise that back in 1911 they're struggling with this idea of name, and they are even suggesting through Tidings, which was the formal publication of the Brethren then in Australia, that idea of how we should name ourselves. Of course, the term that began to emerge was this term gathered to the name of the Lord Jesus, sometimes in brackets, alone, or without brackets. Now, we need to recognise that that was a name that was not there from the beginning. And I believe very much it to be a shibboleth. It certainly arose out of the need of truth, and it was one of their slogans which emerged in the 1880s. And I fear that it was almost bred a kind of elitism, a separatism that was very little different from saying, as those Christians did in Corinth, I am of Christ. Now, there are many articles in Word and Work, that was your New South Wales magazine in the 50s and 60s, critical of the use of the term brethren. And even as magazines began to emerge, have you noticed what we call our magazines? We don't use the word brethren in any of them. We do call Assembly Links, Assembly Challenge in Tasmania, Assembly Alert in Brisbane. And as I was following through all the things that we were writing and looking for the term brethren, I read through Emmaus Roadworks and was quite surprised to find the term brethren did not appear once in any of the statements about what this is all about. It was as though they had deleted the name entirely. And that was also true of the GLO publications. That is, it didn't say this is a magazine published by the Christian Brethren, or anything like that. Well, this is a Bible college run by the Christian Brethren. It seems to me, at least in the ones that I looked at, I'm not saying I looked at them all for this thing, but I picked up some to try and find how they'd describe the editorial policy and what this was about, and they had omitted the term brethren entirely. Now, we also know that in earlier days, at least one thing identified us, and that was gospel halls. And indeed, I was recently talking to a bank manager who was not a Christian at all, and he got talking about what I was doing, and mind you, I was after $100,000 OD for the college, so I had to do the right thing. And so it was very interesting, really. And he said, well, what church do you go to? And of course, That's when you get the lump in the throat, don't you? Hey. How do I tell this Philistine, this pagan, something about the brethren? So I said, well, I personally go to a brethren church. And he said, have they got anything to do with this gospel hall just down the road here? Because he was quite close to Toowong. Now, Toowong Gospel Hall isn't one that you'd hold up. But I would hold up on a high pedestal. And I was a little bit cautious. But very fortunately, he'd known some people who'd gone there, some people who'd banked locally, and he thought reasonably highly, at least, of the people. And so we motored on. But in the past, at least, the term Gospel Hall was something that identified us. But of course, that's gone by the board. And it's interesting to look historically at that shift. For instance, in 1943, in a list of assemblies that was published in Sydney, and I don't think that kind of thing was ever done again. In 43, the assemblies published a list of all assemblies in Australia. Not in tidings, but as a separate booklet. And in 1943, of 33 congregations which owned buildings, 30 were designated as gospel halls. So out of 33 buildings, 30 were designated as gospel halls. The other tended to be Bethesda Hall or Elam Hall or something like that. Now that's of those that were listed there. But in 1988, I looked through a list and found only 6 of 37 assembly buildings in Sydney, at least in the list I found, were designated as gospel halls. On the other hand, get ready to be confused. Names of local assemblies and their church buildings also illustrate the diversity and imprecision. Examples taken from a recent listing of brethren congregations are these: Anala Christian Assembly, Springwood Christian Fellowship, Midway Point Christian Centre, Duffy Gospel Church, Carringbar Bible Chapel, Endergine Bible Centre, Kirwan Bible Fellowship, Panania Gospel Hall, Willoughby Gospel Chapel, Blackwater Christian Brethren Assembly, Carolan Aboriginal Christian Community, Esperance Aboriginal Centre. Some of these terms refer to the meeting place and others describe the fellowship itself. But it's one of the reasons why people outside have very little understanding of who we are, even though we really have a lot to talk about. And let me just read the conclusion I put here. One problem the outsider then, or which confronts the outsider when maybe at times confusing to the insider, is that the name used by brethren congregations or found on the church building may not explicitly now define it as brethren. The local congregations may also find them separated from other brethren congregations because of the choice of a name. Circles of fellowship do exist between congregations which use a common description. We might, however, argue that if the use of a name suggests denominationalism, then the proliferation of names may need to lead to further schisms. The inability to agree on a name has contributed to the lack of unity within congregations linked by our tradition. The refusal to take a name, once regarded as symbolic of pristine Christianity, has become one reason for our organisational weakness. Now, I can offer no solution. And I do not think that any of us can get together and even group-wise say, this will be our name, that we're beyond that now. But we've got to realise that it is not something essentially spiritual or biblical or marvellous to have done this. It is a fact of history, and we've got to work through the implications of that problem we've had with the theology around finding a name. Let me move to point 2, which is the issue of ecumenism. Now, from the very beginning, the brethren rightly recognised they were part of a whole. But how do you give evidence of this and yet talk about your distinctives? I wrote down here, do we say they are of us? But we're not real sure of that. Do we say we are of them? But we'd certainly have to put an exclamation mark after that. Maybe we just say we are related. But you see, we really have problems in relating and talking about how we relate to the local Baptist church, even more so to the local Anglican church. And then there, of course, is the Roman Catholics, where more and more we're beginning to realise God is there, and there are some Christians within those communities. Now, even at the beginning, our brethren leadership had trouble with this problem of ecumenism. And as I looked at the lives of our founders, of Groves, Darby and Mueller, it's interesting to note their different attitudes to ecumenism. And again, I've made a classification. Classifications have a danger sometimes of being a little simplistic, but on the other hand, if you talk about everything they did, sometimes it's hard to put a tab on it. So, I have suggested that Groves was an idealist, or he had an idealist ecumenism. Now, if you read the story of Groves, of course, he was at the very beginning. There were really no brethren churches when he took off for Baghdad, and finally when he went to India, he found no brethren churches. And as he moves around, he walked freely into churches and believed that he had a right to speak, and frequently he found that to be reciprocal, and they were happy for him to speak. He wrote those marvellous words. He said, "I want to know nothing amongst our fellow Christians but this one fact. Do they know Christ?" He did not want them to understand all the light that he thought he might have had, but rather that they had life, and he made that polarization. Let us talk about life in Christ, not light in terms of how much we might know about the scriptures. Now, as he tried to put this into practice in India, as he marched around from place to place, he found ultimately that he could not do it. And this, he met this particularly at Chittoor, which was a place not far from Bangalore, where I spent 5 years of my life. He'd gone there, and there was an Anglican church. And in his own way, he offered his spiritual gifts, and they were happy to accept it. He frequently preached there. But he went back to England for a furlough, came back, and the Anglican hierarchical minister there had changed. And this minister would have nothing to do with a lay preacher. And suddenly Groves found himself without a congregation. He had a number of things that he had done there which were very progressive, had not worked. He attempted to set up businesses which would support mission, and they hadn't worked. And people knew about this, and so he began to be shunned, and found that the only place that he could go and preach were congregations that he himself had established, or that some missionaries he brought from England had established in India. And so he began to realize before the end of his life that this idea, this idealistic ecumenism, doesn't work. Now, I suppose I dare not put myself in the same league as Anthony Norris Groves, but in my own ministry, at least in this denominational college, I would speak in Anglican churches and in Presbyterian churches, currently Uniting Churches, Baptist churches, and you'll be pleased to know, some of the real flock. And as far as I'm concerned, I find that I can find acceptance there, but these people still know, by the things I say, where I come from. It is almost impossible these days to have this ideal ecumenism and be, as it were, a person outside of all systems who is just going to come and share your faith. We share it with some kind of bias. Let's talk about Darby, because he became extremely influential. And I've written here that Darby's was a dogmatic ecumenism. An ecumenism which rode roughshod over all opposition. By presence or by correspondence, uniformity was enforced. That is, he agreed in ecumenism, but it was his brand of ecumenism. It was his brand of church. He wanted everybody to be part of that, you see. And if you weren't, you were wrong, and you were outside the real circle. And so what we call exclusivism developed. Now, tragically, I suggest that is the kind of ecumenism that many of us have, by default, espoused. We want to force it. It doesn't work, and it is unbiblical, and does not do justice to the extent and reality of the kingdom of God. George Mueller was the third of our founders. Now, Mueller's an interesting person because he learned his theology in the marketplace or in the workplace. If he was baptized, it wasn't something that he discovered himself so much as people told him about as he was involved in ministry. And he thought it through, and agreed to get baptized. By the way, of course, it was some ladies who taught him that. Delete that. Interesting. But you find some of the things that Mueller learns as he begins his ministry work at Bristol. He is constantly learning. And I put down here that Mueller's, in fact, was a practical ecumenism. It was not idealistic, nor was it dogmatic, but it was practical. And so when he began his great missionary tours, both of America and Australia, he didn't visit brethren churches. There were very few of them around. But he visited in America the great Presbyterian churches. He spoke from the great theological colleges, including Yale and Princeton. He came to Australia, and his meetings were supported mainly by people outside brethren churches. As I say, when he came here in the 80s, there weren't a lot of brethren churches around anyhow. That's the 1880s. There weren't a lot of brethren churches around. He didn't come here flying the brethren flag. He came here flying a Christian flag, and everybody embraced him. It was a practical ecumenism, and yet he was very much, I think, I hope, one of us. Now, there are three models which began the system. They are very different, and somehow we've got to bring these things together. The brethren were always felt to be outside the main church system. I'm not sure of the date, but about 1846, Evangelical Alliance was commenced in Great Britain. It was formed to combat three heresies. Listen to them. Popery, the Catholics, Puseyism, which was high Anglicanism, and Plymouthism. The Evangelical Alliance, in 1846, formed to combat what they saw as three heresies, and we were one of them. Now, you will be pleased to know that in the redraft of that a year later, Plymouthism was dropped. And the other two remained. But it gives some idea of how, even by 1846-47, the brethren were perceived as people who would have nothing to do with them. And as far as they're concerned, unfortunately and tragically, we were not one of them. Now, you will read then in our writings considerable talk about the universal church and the local church. Now, again, I was fascinated to see how our writers have handled the universal church, because it's quite different from the way the rest of the church handles this term, the universal church. From the very beginning of when Christians had some kind of freedom, the church got together its bishops, and they talked about ecumenical councils, that is, world councils. And the arrangement was, any bishop across the world in 325 was invited to a huge council that Constantine the emperor set up to discuss theological issues. And from that time, it was thought that they should have councils whereby any bishop could come together to discuss issues and make decisions. And such continued up till the time of the Reformation, being called ecumenical councils, although by then they were no longer ecumenical, because the church had certainly divided into East and West, the Catholic or the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches. But nonetheless, this idea of getting together representatives of the universal church was part of church history. The brethren, however, said, you cannot call together the universal church. Why? Because it is the body of people from the days of Christ until now. Collectively, that is the universal church. Therefore, it is impossible to say, let us get all the church together. Let's the universal church get together. Let it discuss something. You cannot do it, they said. Now, this allowed them, of course, to say, we're not going to be involved in any world church or ecumenical church because you can't get it together. Now, to say that to me was a fascinating interpretation. On the other hand, they talk much, of course, about the local church, a body of believers, but ultimately this was a body of believers who do the right things and think the right way. It was, I think, much more defined than the New Testament would have defined it. But that's something maybe you can think through. Now, on this issue of ecumenism, notice also that some of our people have objected to interdenominational relationships. That is, they wanted to keep our separateness by saying, let's not even touch them in outside ministries. It seems to me that the real corruption of ourselves by these outside ministries came at the time of the Billy Graham Crusade. Now, brethren had been involved in outside works before that, and I've documented people who were part of the Bible Society very early on. Some leading brethren lay people were involved in those kind of ministries. But in the Billy Graham Crusade, suddenly the brethren, for the very best of reasons, were thrown aside alongside all of the churches. And if you look at Word and Work, your magazine down here, you'll find that a number of the people were critical, for instance, of our ladies going and singing in the choir with their heads not covered. Was this really the start of it? Was that the corruption where it all began? I mean, we know that there has been these things. The idea of head coverings now are gone, or at least are going. Where did it start? There are those people who say it was this association with the others in this Billy Graham Crusade. Just as an aside, if you read the story of the Billy Graham Crusade by Dr. Barton Babbage, who, by the way, is quite a good friend of mine because I sit on the Australian College of Theology board meetings, of which he's the registrar, I read his story, Shadow of the Cross, which was the story of the Billy Graham Crusade in Australia. Do you know he wrote that entire history without making a single reference to the brethren? Now, that was wrong. But you see, where could he get information? That's one question. But secondly, he, along with others, had been very unhappy about our dispensationalism and regarded us almost as a sect and as heretical. And for that reason, excluded our name from that history of what God did in 59. Now that's tragic. And he should not have done it. You've only got to read the records, because we were there in huge numbers, and in fact the Billy Graham record showed that percentage-wise, the brethren had more people involved in that than the other denomination in Australia. You see, so we were there then. And then you've only got to look at the Gideons, the Christian businessmen. You've only got to look at Scripture Union and the Bible Society and all of these other organisations to find the huge involvement that their brethren have been in outside organisations. We have been involved in those things, and in many cases it's been the salvation of some of our best people. I have a father-in-law who really got Gideon's going, or at least was there right at the very beginning, and who was the first Australian to get on the international board. He also got Christian businessmen's going in Queensland. He's currently on the board of Prison Fellowship worldwide. And I feel that my father-in-law, who is still very loyal to the system, brethren system I mean, could not have survived in brethrenism with the gifts, the administrative and leadership gifts he had, if he was confined to a small church, which in many ways would have tried to constantly clip his wings. And I think this has been a marvellous opportunity for both the development of leadership and for the exercise of that in our outside, in our people. Now, maybe there are theological considerations that I maybe should take a little bit more on board if I want to be extremely orthodox. But pragmatically and practically, we have been blessed immensely because our people have gone out there and done that, worked out their giftedness and come back and then stayed within our ranks. Indeed, maybe we haven't learnt enough. Maybe one of the things that can happen out there is that we can see also what's happening. And out of Assembly Links, I read this. Let me again read it to you. It's by Mr. Quinton. Christian assemblies, as we know them, stand removed from many of the present-day movements in the ecclesiastical world. As with some sheltered isle in a sequestered bay, the tides and swift currents which wash, and this is very poetic, which wash upon many a denominational shore, leave us practically unaffected. Perhaps we should be glad this is so, tongue in cheek, I suspect, that the controversies and trends which are sweeping the churches along a seemingly inexorable course to disaster have not intruded yet into our quiet waters. It is needful, however, to be reminded that this splendid isolation has elements of selfish blindness. Now, sometimes we didn't listen to prophets whom God raised up and who wrote those things, and we just passed over them glibly. But now, 30 years later, we can look back on a statement like that and say, that man was a prophet. He saw things clearly. And although I in no way endorse a lot of what happens in Pentecostal churches, let me go on record to say that if the brethren got it right in the 19th century, and I believe we did, the charismatics in many ways have got it right in the 20th. And we need at times to know what they're doing and to learn from them. And I watch Uniting Churches and some other churches and Baptist churches in Brisbane, which are exploding, and God is blessing them. And if we don't take time to see and learn, we will become this sheltered island, more and more irrelevant, until we're washed over by the tides of time. I don't want that. And I'm still very positive about many things within the assembly, but those are lessons we need to learn from history. I'm just trying to think, look, that may well be enough to feed you with right now. I think the time, quarter past, I was supposed to finish. And since now we've got an extra session tonight, I will put into it leadership structures, and after I pray and think this through very carefully, something about women's ministry.